WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Last year, my guest Harris Wofford won the Pennsylvania race for U.S. Senate. This Democratic victory was considered the first sign that President Bush was vulnerable. Wofford's campaign helped set the tone for the Clinton campaign. Wofford's opponent, Richard Thornburg, had been Bush's attorney general. When the Senate race began, Wofford was over 40 points behind in the polls. His successful campaign was run by James Carville, who managed Clinton's campaign after Wofford's victory. Wofford is in his mid-60s, but this was the first time he ever ran for office. He had served in the Kennedy administration, where he was the president's special assistant for civil rights and co-founder of the Peace Corps. In the 70s, Wofford was the president of Bryn Mawr College. He later worked in the administration of Pennsylvania Governor Bob Casey. There's a new edition of Wofford's 1980 book about his work with the Kennedys and Martin Luther King called Of Kennedys and Kings. Wofford was with the Peace Corps in Africa when Kennedy was assassinated. I asked him how he got the news.
We got the call from a friend who had heard the radio at the embassy, and it was unbelievable. I tried to hitch a ride on the emperor's plane to come back for the funeral. I heard he was leaving in his big jet, and I came down from our mountain in a jeep, and I changed into a suit from work clothes in the car. And I knew they'd let me on because the emperor had a very warm spot in his heart for the Peace Corps, and I'd worked well with him. And they let us go out onto the runway. The jet was there, and we were rushing out on the runway. And just as our jeep was 100 yards from the plane, it swooped off and took off, and I didn't make it.
Oh, you must have been upset.
I would rather have been at the funeral.
Last year, you ran for office for the first time. After having served in the Kennedy administration in Pennsylvania, you served in Governor Bob Casey's administration. You've been the president of Bryn Mawr College, a university professor. But this was the first time that you actually ran for office.
Right.
You won in a kind of surprising victory because you ran against Dick Thornburg.
I started 47 points down.
Right.
Ended 10 points up.
Why in your 60s did you decide to run for office for the first time?
Well, like John Kennedy, how did you become a hero? He said, they sank my boat. We had a terrible tragedy in the loss of John Hines, and I had out of that an opportunity, I hoped, to make something good come out of the tragedy. I got appointed, and once appointed, I wanted to see through the job. I relished the campaign and the chance to earn the seat, which I was the first bird of spring for the change that is coming now. And when people sent me up, they weren't sure that I'd get through. But I didn't create the change, but I signaled that there's a winter of discontent that people felt. And I helped ride that wave of discontent, which is now the challenge of the president-elect to turn into something creative.
Now, James Carville headed your campaign, and of course he afterwards went to work for the Clinton campaign, and the strategy that he used on your campaign was obviously very successful, and I think he pursued a similar strategy with the Clinton campaign. Tell me why you decided to hire him.
Well, I'd seen him in action in the Bob Casey campaign. I was chairman of the Democratic Party, another odd thing for me to have done, but in 86...
This is in the state of Pennsylvania.
In Pennsylvania, excuse me. I was asked... we were sitting in Pennsylvania, and you were reaching the whole country. I was Pennsylvania state chairman, and we hired James Carville to be the campaign chief and Paul Begala, and I saw that team in action, and I thought they were the kind of coaches that would be very good for me, who had not run before. And one of the things they do best is what you need to do in interviews, I'm sure. The danger for someone like me, they felt, and they felt this way about Clinton, is that we're interested in a lot of different ideas and have done a lot of things and pursue ideas, and we could talk about those all over the map of Pennsylvania or the United States. And Carville's main message to a candidate is the discipline of the message. One day I finally told him that I understand it because a few years ago I read all of Lincoln's speeches from the Lincoln-Douglas debates to the first inaugural, and they were on one subject, how to save the Union without expanding slavery or how to check slavery without destroying the Union. He argued and re-argued it. It was the most disciplined of the message campaign in our history. And that's what Carville urges you to do. And he helped me pick the key issues of our economy and health care. And he's done the same with Clinton.
Yeah, with Clinton, it was the economy. With you, I think the main focus was probably health care.
And the economy.
And the economy. So what were the most compelling things he said to you about the importance of keeping a focus, of limiting the number of issues you're going to talk about during the campaign?
Well, he helped make clear to me how the people, James has got a lot of touch with the whole range of different people that make up the people, how the people are so inundated with information that you've got to go through the opening where it is, and you've got to go through it hard and clear. They don't all love politics. People are ready for the ball game or any number of other things. And so you've got to go through that narrow opening where people are ready to, with all their skepticism, to think, well, maybe this fellow's better than the other, or maybe this is a time we can use the ballot to change things. It doesn't usually happen, but maybe. And you've got to seize that moment and to do it clearly and with one, two, three issues. And he also turned my mind around on this question of the 30-second television ads, which I've always thought were abominable. And yet, it was those ads, not my debate with Dick Thornburg, that reached the homes of everybody in Pennsylvania. And he said, instead of having puff stuff about you or negative stuff about the opponent, go on those ads and show what you believe. And just the fact you're fighting and believing in something will let them know who you are better than puff stuff about you were president of Bryn Mawr or things like this.
Well, let me ask you about those ads. One of the ads, and this was about about health insurance. It said, at a time when government seems to care about everyone in the world but us, Harris Wofford says, it's time to take care of Americans again. It's time to take care of our own. That's an interesting statement coming from someone who, let's face it, was a co-founder of the Peace Corps. I mean, obviously, you feel strongly about international concerns. So did you feel kind of misrepresented by this ad in any way?
I sweated over that ad. The basic proposition that you can't be strong abroad if you're weak at home, a John Kennedy quote, was my theme. It never was intended to mean we should be weak abroad, we should not do things abroad. It meant that you're not going to do it abroad effectively if you're weak at home. I agree that ad can mislead, and I went to some length after my election to say that the message was not that we should not respond to the needs of the former Soviet Union or Eastern Europe. In fact, I was one of the leaders in the Senate pressing for a rapid, strong response to help them. But I was saying it's wrong, it's right that we respond to the needs of the people of Bangladesh and to the Kurds, but it's wrong that we don't put the same energy and resources and commitment to our own problems. And I did take some responsibility afterwards to try to say it wasn't an isolationist message.
Now, I want to ask you something else about the political process and becoming a part of it. You've spent most of your career either serving in state or federal administrations or in academia, again, as president of Bryn Mawr College or a professor there. And especially in the world of academia, discourse is a very important part of what you do, and it can be done over the course of more time than you're allowed in politics, especially when you're on the stump. And especially now in politics, all candidates are advised to speak in sound bites so that it can get on the TV news and get quoted in the press. How did you learn how to do that when you needed to do that?
Just had to do it by practice. You were counseling me to be shorter in a conversation, and so was James Carville, and so was my wife, always, for many years. So when you have to do it, you do it. But also now we can break through. One of the things of this campaign that's promising, I think, is candidates are now breaking through to talk shows where you can talk this way.
So you like that?
I love it, and so did I do a lot of it in the campaign, and so, of course, did Clinton and Perot and, in the end, even Bush.
Your successful campaign is now seen as a kind of a precursor of what was to come later with Bill Clinton's successful campaign. Did you feel like a test case when you were campaigning? And did you feel that, like, somehow the Democratic Party's future was resting on your shoulders in some way because your your election was being watched as a harbinger of what was to come.
I had a feeling of that because Thornburg was the candidate, and he had come from being attorney general, and he was sent off from the White House. His launching pad was the White House when he announced that he was going to do it. And however, my campaign colleagues, James Carville, kept saying, above all, don't make this a referendum on Bush. Don't ever attack Bush. He's 80% favorable. Stick to Thornburg and Washington Insider, but don't take on Bush. And I didn't until the last week of the campaign, and I got carried away at a rally in Washington, Pennsylvania. Someone said, Senator, your election's going to mean the first day of the end of the Bush administration. And I went up and began my speech with that, and the audience went wild with applause. And the AP picked it up and put it in every paper in Pennsylvania. Wofford says it's going to be the first day of the end of the Bush administration, referendum on the Bush administration. Carville, Begala, my two sons, lashed me and said, you may have blown it. Don't ever say anything like that again. And in fact, Bush's popularity had fallen and people were sensing the country was on the wrong track. And so I had the pleasure in my victory statement of beginning by saying our election marks the first day of the end of the Bush administration.
My guest is Senator Harris Wofford of Pennsylvania. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Harris Wofford, Democratic Senator from Pennsylvania. There's a new edition of his 1980 book of Kennedys and Kings, Making Sense of the 60s. You were a co-founder of the Peace Corps, and now as a senator, you've proposed a service corps. What are you proposing, and what connections do you see between that and the Peace Corps?
Well, it is a proposal to bring the idea of the Peace Corps home on a big scale. We had that dream, you might say, in the 60s, a million-strong Peace Corps in America. In those days, we probably thought of it like one big United States Peace Corps at home, run by a director of the Peace Corps. Nowadays, I wouldn't think of it that way. I would think of percolation up from all kinds of different corps. The Wall Street Journal today has an article on a Durham, North Carolina youth corps on its front page. Philadelphia has a youth service corps. One of the best, maybe the best in the country, is the Boston City Year, which has diversity by design, half college-bound, half not college-bound, half minority, half not, a real experience in integration. There are hundreds of little youth service corps. A student at Princeton started Teach for America, which has 1,000 volunteer teachers that are in action. And I would have a system like the GI Bill, and more important, I think this is what Clinton has in mind, a system like the GI Bill in which you get a minimum allowance for a year or two of service and an educational bonus afterwards that'll help you pay for college. But you can take that voucher, in a sense, to a whole range of options in service. And if you get admitted, then you get your expenses and the bonus if you complete it. And in other words, a great diversity of service programs and an invitation to colleges and churches and businesses and civic groups to find out how to tap the talent of young people and put it to work to improve our communities.
Is your primary goal with this to improve communities or to provide like training and temporary employment for young people, or a combination of the two?
Well, I would say a combination of the two. And it's very important that the psychological key to why the experience in a service corps can be so important, in addition to getting an esprit de corps that you get in that kind of an intense program if it's well led, is the sense that you're needed. A young youth service corps man in Philadelphia had been in a street gang. I probed, why are you in it? And he said, finally, after joshing, well, this work, I might not get killed in a different gang. He said, you know, I joined this because all my life people have been coming to do good against me, to help me. Good people have come to our housing project. It's the first time in my life anybody asked me to do something. And I listened to him and I said, that is exactly what the first Peace Corps volunteer asked that on the White House lawn said when they said, why did you, the silent generation, and hundreds of thousands volunteer to go to the Peace Corps? And he said, nobody had ever asked me to do anything patriotic, unselfish, or for the common good before. Kennedy asked. And I think that's what young people, in fact, that's what all of us want, is to be needed.
No, the way our American political system works, if you want people to vote for your bill, you've got to kind of vote for their bill, too. That's often what happens behind the scenes in Congress.
You say that, but yeah. I've been in Congress a year and a half.
And I've never
And
been.
No one has ever come up and
Is
proposed
right?
anything like that to me. No one has ever said, I'll support your Civilian Conservation Corps, Service Corps bill if you'll support my bill.
So are you saying that we have a stereotype that doesn't exist or that you've just managed to avoid that?
I didn't try to avoid it. I'm open to the whole experience. I'm just saying in a year and a half, there's never been a conversation like that with another senator.
Has anyone tried to get your vote on something?
And certainly. Just the way I've helped build with Senator Boren and with Senator Nunn and Mikulski. I've tried to build a coalition for the idea of national service. I'm sort of known as Mr. National Service, and I am working both sides of the aisle, and I was elated when I discovered that Senator Domenici was interested in it, and Senator Warner and Senator Dole particularly. I've been working very hard on that, and I'll have to work, I've been working and will be working all out to build a coalition to get national health care through.
What are your hopes for the near future for health care reform?
I take Bill Clinton very seriously in what he says, and he has said that within the first 100 days, the President of the United States will propose to Congress a fundamental, comprehensive health care reform bill. I expect to be in the shaping of that bill, and I was with Governor Clinton in New Jersey at the Merck Company, along with Jay Rockefeller. We were the two he had there by his side as he launched his health care proposals. I will fight all out to get those through. It won't get passed in the first 100 days. There will be hearings. There will be a battle royal. But the difference now is, why I'm full of hope, is that we have a president who will fight for it the way Roosevelt fought for Social Security. He will call the players to the table. He will preside over the bargaining when necessary. And I think within the first year of the Clinton administration, we will have a major health care reform bill passed.
Do you think it will be like the health care reform bill that you've proposed?
We've all agreed to put our own bills aside, but it's very much in line. His thinking is very much in line with my approach, yes.
Can you give us a sketch of what you think the health care reform might look like, or are you not prepared to do that until there's more discussions and more consensus?
Well, we came close to a consensus in the Senate that the public and the press doesn't realize. We had some months ago agreed to put our individual bills aside and look at the ingredients that needed to be put together. And we were really very close to a Democratic consensus before the election adjournment came. I think what Governor Clinton is asking for, which is what I want, is a combination of a national budgeting, a national package of health care rights that you have all your life, that you have a computer or electronic card that plugs you into them and that would help with a single, simplified, inexpensive billing system that could go from job to job and from state to state, and that we have a voice nationally, a National Health Commission that looks at the future of health, AIDS, projecting the aid and aging issue, two different issues, all the complex problems. We have a national center that looks where we're going in healthcare and shows us how we can stop the out-of-control costs that are going up for everybody, for our federal budget, families, and the rest, but that the delivery system and the way you organize this not be a federally run bureaucracy, but maybe we even get rid of the present bureaucracy and it be locally driven.
I would imagine that on some level, you're kind of standing back from your experience in politics and always looking at it and analyzing it. Do you know what I mean? Analyzing the American political process and everything. And I'm wondering if on some level you're grateful that you got to spend some time under a Republican administration and now you'll be working under a Democratic administration, just for the sake of kind of intellectually comparing the two, even though I know you have partisan interests as a Democrat and will probably prefer serving under a Democratic administration for that reason.
Well, I think the experience that I needed to have and that most other senators, for example, have is what it's like to be in opposition, in effect, and to know that, well, we got one bill through over the veto of the president out of 37, and to know the government of the United States doesn't work when you have that kind of gridlock and each end of Pennsylvania Avenue is blaming the other, I think it's set the stage for a real response from Congress to say, there's no longer any excuse. We have a united Democratic administration. You better work together as a team. You better not blow this. You'd better not miss this opportunity. The ending of the gridlock gives us a chance to prove that government can work. And we have that responsibility now. In some ways, it was easier to be an oppositionist. I could criticize President Bush, and, you know, it was easy to just stand there talking and fighting. But now we really have the possibility of getting these things done, national health insurance, for example. And if we fail in the next year or two, there's going to be a depression of the spirit in the country. And just as I rode in on a wave of discontent, if the discontent gets deeper, I'll ride out. I come up in 2 years. So I'll be in, just as I was a little test of the fact that people wanted change, I might be the first bird, the first duck that gets shot down if we don't succeed. And it puts a tremendous challenge to the Democrats to draw together, to be a team, to not just be little barons speaking for ourselves, but to get the common good first again.
I just want to ask you something that really isn't related to politics at all, and it goes back to your childhood. For 6.5 months, your grandmother took you out of school when you were a kid to travel with you around the world, which is a very unusual situation for a kid, something I'm sure a lot of kids wish had happened to them. Why did she do that? What was your parents' reaction?
Well, my parents let me do it, and they paid for the tour. I was still half fare when we bought the tickets, and 12 years old when I went. And they later joked that they blamed that trip and my grandmother from Little Rock, Arkansas, who was a Southern Democrat, for turning me into a Democrat. It was a Republican family. And the experience of hearing Mussolini in Rome take Italy out of the League of Nations from his speech in the Piazza Venezia, of seeing Arabs shooting at Jews in Bethlehem on Christmas Eve, of seeing Gandhi in the streets of Bombay, of seeing the going through the bombed out streets of Shanghai after the Japanese had taken over, that experience, one, interested me in the world in a deep way that led to the Peace Corps in some sense, or my interest in it. And secondly, my Republican father joked for that all that time with my Democrat Little Rock grandmother turned me into a Democrat.
Harris Wofford, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Good to be with you, Terry.
Senator Harris Wofford, there's a new edition of his book of Kennedys and Kings, Making Sense of the 60s. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.